This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of the show, here with another staff pick from our archives. In his interview with the movement guru Katie Bowman, Doug highlighted a disturbing statistic. Teens today walk just 11 minutes a day. Think about that. There are 1,440 minutes in a day, and American teenagers spend less than 1% of those walking. And when I heard that, it made me ask, how much do I walk? How much do I move in a day? Because for Bowman, movement is the key to health. Notice I didn't say exercise. When she joined us back in 2015, Bowman laid out the details of her radically simple fitness philosophy, and it goes like this. Exercise less, move more. Here's the conversation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's one of the surprising ways Katie Bowman explains human movement in the modern world. She says we live in a time when movement has been almost entirely outsourced. So in a real way, moving is not really required today. But it's not that modern environments keep us from moving around, she says. It just makes it easier to choose to drive instead of walk, or to choose to push your kids in a stroller rather than carry them. As she writes in her book, we slouch into our furniture, we let our shoes support our feet. And Bowman says, of course, technology and the advancement of science and medicine has been crucial in human development. But she's also pretty candid when she says we are, in fact, dying slowly in bits from our natural tendency to do as little as possible. Think of coronary heart disease. Think of metabolic disorders like type 2 diabetes. Think allergies and hypertension and osteoarthritis and asthma and gout. Bowman is getting a lot of attention for her approach to all of this. She says the only way out of this poor physical state is to return to the behaviors of our ancestors. That's why she doesn't really have furniture in her own house, for example, like a sofa or a recliner. They don't have kitchen chairs. They don't have conventional tables. It's why she and her husband don't use strollers for their two young kids. They carry them. Today in the program, Katie Bowman is joining us to explain human biomechanics and why she thinks we should be exercising less, but moving more and better. In the process, she says, you might just change your DNA. Katie Bowman is a biomechanist and the founder and director of the Restorative Exercise Institute. It's an organization and an online training program that teaches the biomechanical model of preventive medicine. She blogs and podcasts also at katiesays.com, and she's the author of several books. Her newest is called Move Your DNA. We'll be talking about that one today. Katie Bowman is joining us today from her home in Washington State. Katie Bowman, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with, there's something you write in your latest book where you say that you've spent about 20 years studying human biomechanics, and you say you've always seemed to have had this fascination for movement and cells. And I'm wondering, where do you figure that came from? Why have you always been fascinated in this?
I don't know. My earliest memory of what I can see my lifelong passion stemming from is watching Wizard of Oz, specifically the Tin Man, and when he needed the oil can and his joints. And I really, really remember thinking, wow, is that what I look like underneath? And the levers of the Tin Man, the hinges really jumped out at me at, I don't know, age 6 or 7, I'm not even sure.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, how things work, I'm always just kind of a how things work kind of person, but I'm also a very, I'm systems, how integration, how large scale systems work. And I don't know, I think that might have been the first spark of interest for me.
You raised this question in your book, which is, what if we moved away from this culture of convenience and tried to return to the behaviors of our ancient ancestors? When did that, do you think, insight kind of occur to you first?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I grew up on a farm, which required quite a bit of movement. And my grandparents and great-grandparents, they were certainly not sedentary. They moved quite a bit. But I would say, and as did I as well, because I was out there, you know, laying pipe and trimming trees and harvesting fruit. But I would say when I was in graduate school, on the first day of class, we had to answer, like, what were we most interested in? And I was really into posture, this idea that different cultures have different postural traits that convey certain feelings like pride or shame. And there's these physical adjustments that they were able to test and find that just by flashing images of how someone's body parts were arranged, they were able to predict the emotion that that person was having. And it varied by culture. And then I just started to think, well, what about pre-culture? And I think, again, that just began along this line of when, obviously, you know, we communicate in many different ways, in words, but also in our physical arrangements. And then what was the benefit of that? And how had that come to be? And I think of that, again, that was part of me starting to think about human science. You know, I was already into studying human anatomy. But then as you get deeper into a science, recognizing that what I had really learned about human anatomy was about American anatomy or Western culture anatomy. And then there was this book on anatomical variation. And then I just started to think outside my own culture. And that's where that broader perspective of a human timeline, I think, entered my work.
Yeah. One of the sort of central ideas of the book is this concept of movement nutrition. Explain that briefly, if you would. This is the idea that movement, like food, is not optional for our bodies.
Yeah, you know, I think people could say, they could identify the nutrient. Vitamin C is such a good example. We can understand that vitamin C is an essential compound, and without it, you could probably even list scurvy, right? If you went to second grade, as a disease that would arise in the environment in which no vitamin C would be found. But the vitamin C itself isn't nutritious. It's the nutrition is how the vitamin C interacts with the body. What processes it fulfills or creates in the body. And there has been for some time this looking at humans and in biomechanics and in biological sciences, specifically when it comes to bone. Bone's a good example of, you know, we have these issues of bone, but it could be that we're just not reaching a peak, that there's this idea that there's a certain amount of bony mechanical stimulation. And so I think I just started to think about what if we could quantify loads. So I break movement down into loads, and that the load was the input in the same way that the vitamin C was the input, because the load itself brings about processes in the body, and that there are these mechanical inputs that are very much required in the same way that there are these chemical compounds that we have to input. Because in the end, the chemical compound, the mineral or the vitamin or the movement, all is going to change into activity within a cell that affects the cellular behavior. So it's just this idea of, wow, there really are nutrients. There are essential loads that without them, we see diseases in the same way that we see in the void of particular nutrients.
So I know my body tells me that I'm lacking nutrients by me getting hungry. What's the signal that where my body is saying, hey, I need movement? Is there a similar kind of impulse?
I don't know would be, I think, the easiest answer to that. Or I would have to be speculation at this point, because before there was nutritional science where you could go out and buy a book, you know, but had the list of nutrients for you. There were hundreds of years of people in these different little pockets, in these different scenarios that had a robust, they would have a good diet. You know, they weren't necessarily starving. I'm not talking about starving populations. There were adequate calories, but there was some sort of nutritional void. And then there were diseases that would arise in this case. And it would take hundreds of years to figure out what that was. And I think that we are just at the beginning of understanding that we are at a deficit. And so I don't know. I think that answer will probably be more clear. What are the signals? I mean, clearly the diseases themselves that arise are the bigger signals. But things like pain, and I in the book, you know, I highlight things like basic biological functions that aren't working for you. You know, that's in the same way. That's what all diseases are, right? They're just there's some change in that. And then for my children, I think that parents kind of recognize when their kids need to move, right? There's just this general, whether it's a frustration or an excitement or the pressure seems to go up in the room and it's like these kids need to move. It's a lot easier to recognize that children need to move, and we've forgotten that we ourselves have that same need. But just a general discomfort and a problem with our basic biology, I would say would probably be the easiest way to say that you need to move more at this point, or to realize you need to move more at this point.
Help us understand this idea of loads a little bit more, because you write in the book that the physical expression that is your body is the sum total of these loads that are experienced by your cells. And this is a big one for you. The idea of breaking it down, not just into, you know, big organ groups. You like to break it down to the cellular level. This is an important way, I think, of understanding how this all works. But help us understand loads, because one of the things you say in the book is you say you say picture standing in a forest. So help us understand this idea of a load and how that affects us.
Well, you're in the forest. We can just keep going with that. You're standing in the forest, and a breeze or a wind comes through the forest. And if you look up, that one breeze or wind is deforming, meaning it's changing the shape of all of the trees that are experiencing that breeze or that wind. You can see the leaves rustle. You can see the main trunk of a tree bend slightly, and the smaller branches wave, whether in response to the breeze or the response to the main trunk waving. So it's all very connected. And in science, specifically in biomechanics, it's very difficult to quantify the movement of the tree. It's a lot easier to put up a tool to measure the movement of the wind. So we can say that this wind was a certain amount of knots at a certain direction. And that itself, I think we've focused on that because it's easy to measure. And then we try to understand the forest, the health of the trees, the health of the forest, the health of the animals that live in those areas based on how we've measured the wind. But the wind is really an external applied force. What's happening is the tree itself is experiencing that applied force in many different ways. No two spots on the tree will have been deformed in the same way. That it's an entirely unique experience because the tree, very much like ourselves, is just one body fashioned out of many smaller bodies. And because the part of you, you know, you think, I exercised, so my body adapted. But really, all of your cells are adapting based on to what it is that you are doing. And that it's at the cellular level that we should be most concerned about. So rather than focusing on the wind or even focusing on the tree as a single unit, I like to think about the tree as, you know, 20 parts or 100 parts, or you could do a trillion parts, and figure out what is it about those micro bends, those micro deformations that are telling the tree that are, I mean, they are the tree that are shaping the tree in a particular way to make that tree strong enough to survive that wind so that it doesn't fall down and that it's able to propagate, you know? So that's how I think about loads. Loads is the experience of how you carry your backpack. It is not the weight of your backpack sitting on a scale.
Right. Your perspective on the term genetic is interesting, because you say that most of us, when we use the term genetic, we figure that because of our genes, we kind of accept that our health issues are beyond our control. Well, this is a genetic thing. I've got heart disease in my bloodline or whatever. But in some way, you say that's wrongheaded because it doesn't seem to take into account habitat or the environment, I guess.
Yeah. You know, the term genetic means something biologically, but the way that it's used casually, I believe, has become to be interchangeable with predetermined.
Right.
And so in more understanding of genetics and how much environment plays a role, we've got a separate branch of genetics, which are, you know, everyone, you can have the same genes, but they don't always behave the same way. So then we will call it, well, that's epigenetics. However, those are just terms that are used for scientific investigation for, you know, university organization about what types of classes and information you'll be covering. In the end, everything that you experience is how your genes are behaving, but that isn't as predetermined as we think. It's just not, it's not as simple as you would be however you are despite wherever you lived and whatever time period you lived in, that there is something more complex going on. So I just like to clarify. I think it's helpful, especially when you're struggling with your health, to understand how much choice you actually do have.
Yeah. So interesting you say, because movement is more than, I think a lot of us, and we'll get to this difference between movement and exercise as we go, but a lot of times when we think of movement, that's what we are thinking about is exercise. But you say it's more than that. It's about, here's how you put it in the book, it's about every motion that our bodies have made and every position it has maintained throughout our lives. So we're the sum of all of these movements that we've made all throughout our lives, I guess.
Yes, it's like food is such a great analogy. You don't only adapt to the salad or the fresh produce you choose to eat, you know, when you did, you adapt to everything you have eaten. You are the sum total. You are how you eat. And in the same way, the 1 hour that you exercise a day is not the sum total of your movement experience. Mm. You are loading your cells 100% of the time. It's just that the loads that you put into your body tend to be repetitive because they've just been consumed in the same position over long hours of time. All of that is not considered movement by our understanding of lever systems. But when you look at the cellular movement, your cells have been deformed no matter what it is that you choose to do physically. And that, I think, really needs to be teased out more. That is the crux of it all.
Yeah. There's this study you make a reference to in your book. Today's teens walk an average of 11 minutes a day. The way we move is drastically different from our, you know, ancient ancestors. So I was thinking, it made me think of that movie WALL-E, you know, that Pixar movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that continues, that if we are sort of, kids are at 11 minutes a day, teens, if you sort of extend that logic into the future, I mean, can we kind of imagine a scenario not unlike, you know, the humans in that movie, WALL-E, doughy and sedentary and not at all flexible and just kind of sitting there?
I think that WALL-E was a huge reason that I chose, that I felt compelled to write Move Your DNA. Because, you know, I talk about things like, you know, your feet. Can you lift your toes individually? You've got muscles in your feet, and can you lift your toes individually? And many people cannot lift them one at a time in the same way they can articulate their fingers. And, you know, someone would say, well, like, what's the big deal? Why do I need to be moving my toes individually? It's certainly not necessary. I'm certainly not needing to climb trees anymore for food, or I don't really need excellent balance because my life does not depend any longer on me having, you know, excellent balance. Yet that same argument can be made for the people in WALL-E on the chair. It's like, what does it matter if my legs work or not? This chair can get me anywhere I need to go. So you have to, it's a slippery slope to start justifying weaknesses or inabilities that you come hardwired with simply because they are no longer necessary to execute life as we know it, because technology is advancing so rapidly that it will be, it's I think it's perfectly rational to say that someone could live their entire life in bed and still have a successful career, could still make a paycheck. They could get their food delivered right to their house. They can find a mate online. And that the need to leave the bed or the chair on the spaceship in WALL-E no longer exists for survival in this modern world. Yet, the health experience of someone who could exist solely in bed would reflect their choice to live solely in bed. And so I think that if I'm trying to help people associate these parts of their body that don't move, not as big perhaps as your legs or your arms, maybe you're still able to walk, but maybe, you know, your feet muscles don't support the feet. You need shoes to do that. And it's just one step closer to this, you know, pseudoscientific, you know, place that we're going to come to with WALL-E that may in fact be here in some form.
We have to head to a break here in a moment, but before that, help us compare that, this modern existence now, to growing up, quote unquote, naturally. I mean, take us through that as you do in the book, a body shaped by an all natural, all the time childhood, unmedicated birth. You slept with your parents. You exercised all the time. You were squatting and digging and I think clamoring is how you put it.
Clamoring and being outside in the elements, right? So you've got a million muscles all over your skin that help you regulate your temperature. All those would be working all of the time. The sheer amount of movement. All you have to do is just imagine wherever you are right now looking around and none of that exists. You want water, there's no faucet to walk over to. There's no refrigerator for your food. You would expend almost as much energy looking for your food as you would actually get from your food. It would be such a delicate relationship that, and as you got more food, you would become stronger and could thus get a little bit more food. And you were always in this dynamic, literally dynamic relationship with moving your body for the sake of survival. But, you know, if you compare that to now, you know, most of us had a similar experience where as soon as you're, you know, born, you're driven home, you know, you're driven home in from the hospital in a seat that straps you down. And the bulk of your life, at least in those first couple of years, is very still. You know, you might be given rattles. You cultivate your we were very focused on fine motor skills, you know, with small children and writing and the amount of hours you would sit at your desk using your wrist, you know, holding onto your pencil and fine little loops, but only one side of your body, right? Not the other side that doesn't write. You would have PE, perhaps, if you were still lucky enough to have it, in which case you would go out and, you know, run around for 40 minutes, or maybe learn a sport, something else that's repetitive. Learn these skills. Your physical activity will be boiled down to these 7 skills, which you will do over and over and over again. And then you go back into your desk, and then eventually you transfer to an office. And when you do get your exercise, because you know that you need it, so you consume it in an hour, usually in a place that you have to drive to that requires an outfit, you know, a special shoes to get your movement done, very compartmentalized. And you walk on something that's plugged in, you know, usually like a treadmill. And then you go home and you sit down at your table and then you lie down in your bed with your cushions and your pillows. And then you get back up and you repeat it again and again and again and again. And that's the difference. I mean, I'm really not talking about small differences. I'm talking about vastly different ways of using your arms and your legs and your torso and your skin and your eye muscles, right? What's the farthest thing you've looked at today? For most people, it's no farther than the 30 inches or the 20 feet when they're driving or looking around their house instead of looking off at miles and in the distance that relax the muscles in your eyes. So it's a very deep argument, I guess.
When we get back from a break, we'll talk about why exercise is not enough. And by the way, standing at your desk is not enough. Katie Bowman is with us. She's a biomechanist, founder and director of the Restorative Exercise Institute. She's the author of the book Move Your DNA. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thank you. KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone. Listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Katie Bowman, biomechanist, founder and director of the Restorative Exercise Institute. Her latest book is called Move Your DNA, and we're talking about the importance of movement. I wanted to ask you, one of the things you write about is that exercise is not enough. That, you know, if you jog or if you bike, that, you know, you say only the muscles you've used for that particular exercise are getting the benefits. So talk a little bit about how, because this is one of the important things in your book, is the difference between exercise and movement.
Well, exercise certainly has many excellent qualities. However, when we exercise, we are not having as much of a whole body experience as we think. Yes, all of you may be moving over the ground when you're running or riding your bike, but not all of your body is participating. In fact, what we do know is when people do things that are especially vigorous, that blood is moved away from certain parts of your body to fuel the parts that are working vigorously. And with what happens is we tend to consume the type of exercise that we most prefer over and over again. So if you think about exercise in the same way as, again, a food that contains some nutrients, a food can be nutritious, but a diet cannot consist solely of one food or even three. That what we know about nutrition is that there are many, many foods that you need to consume over a season, over a lifetime, that give us the full spectrum of nutrients that we require, and that there are certain phases of life, whether you're young or older or pregnant, for example, where your nutritional profile changes. That in nature, there is a very organic relationship. But because exercise is not a natural phenomenon, right? It's a man-made thing of trying to, I think, atone, you know, for copious amounts of stillness with something that's particularly noteworthy, that we end up, again, with our favorite foods. And so anyone who exercises regularly perhaps goes, I understand this idea of cross training. I need to definitely, I need to add some yoga, you know, to my running, or if I need to add some cardio to my stretching routine. Because again, what we think of as exercise has got three nutrients, right? There's cardio and strength training and flexibility. And so it's these big kind of clumps. But again, what I'm talking about is in nature, you would be using all of your parts in so many unique ways that so many of your cells would be receiving input that was constantly fluctuating. And so it would be like this idea of cross-training on steroids. It would just be, you would never do the same thing twice. Yes, you would always be walking, you know, different miles to get whatever food you need, but the terrain over which you would be walking would be vastly different because you'd be moving from place to place. You wouldn't be going and doing your daily 3-mile walk through your neighborhood, the same route over the same, where you could even predict the bumps and the cracks, and it's no longer that stimulating. You can talk on the phone while you do it. You don't really need your mind for it, you know, and so that nature really does give you a much broader spectrum of loads, which are the nutrient equivalent. And that's really what movement is. It's all of the very subtle motions that don't get put into the exercise or fitness box because they have nothing to do with the fitness variables, or they have something to do with them, but they have lots of other things to do with supporting biological function.
So, what do you think about a treadmill? A lot of people say, hey, the body can't tell the difference between a trail and a treadmill, but you're like, no, come on, there's a big difference.
Sure, sure. It's a very big difference. I mean, for starters, without even talking about the physical experience of what muscles you use and how you walk, just consider for a moment taking a walk, or better yet, just walk around in your office the next time you have a couple minutes. And what you'll see is as you move forward, your surroundings are streaming past your eyes, right? You move forward and the environment moves relatively behind you. And that's an optic flow, what they call optic flow. And so much about your cadence and the rate at which you walk and your balance is taking in and consuming this data. You've been walking over ground, maybe not as much as you should, but you've been doing it, and your body kind of understands this rate of which your legs move and the rate at which data streams past your eyes. But when you get on a treadmill, your legs are moving, yet to your body, to your mind, to your brain, your body is going nowhere because no data is streaming past your eyes. So it has to make a temporary adjustment to reconcile. And you're not aware of it. It happens so quickly because the body is just amazing. But when you get off the treadmill, you will experience this moment in which your body has had to adjust its perception to this machine. And then all of a sudden you get off, and if you've ever experienced it, it feels like you're moving very, very fast, because now that data is streaming past your eyes, it's your brain wasn't working like that for the time that you were on the treadmill. And that recovery time for how long it takes after you get off the treadmill for your brain and body to be in sync, if you will, takes longer and longer as you get older. And so that's one big difference, is that there's this kind of unsyncing of those parts. But then, of course, walking over ground, just like if you're in a boat, you know, you're rowing your boat forward, you dip the oar down and you push the oar back, and that propels the boat with you in it forward. And walking is very similar to that, where you're digging your leg down into the earth, and then you're pushing the leg back, and your body, which is the boat in this scenario, just swims forward right over that leg. So it's kind of this dig and push back, dig and push back, dig and push back. But on a treadmill, the belt's coming towards you.
Yeah.
So digging and pushing back doesn't work on a treadmill. So now you have to lift the leg out in front of you and fall forward, which is very similar. That lifting your leg out in front of you is, again, the same pattern in your muscles that you use to sit with. So then your treadmill walking doesn't look that much different to those muscles than sitting. You're still using your sitting muscles instead of the opposing muscles. So you're not really getting out of the chair as much as you think you are when you're on these devices.
Well, it's interesting because you also write about, I mean, a lot of us feel incredibly proud of the fact that we got standing desks.
Right.
But you know, but you say standing is not enough, because for the bulk of the day, you say it's just if you're standing there for most of the day, that's just a different version of the same problem.
Yes. If stillness is the problem, standing still all day isn't really the solution. I mean, there are certain things about sitting in the chair, as I write about in the book, that are improved by standing. I'm certainly a big fan of standing workstations, but I predict that in the same way that we've got, you know, sitting is the new smoking, that eventually standing will be the new sitting. And from there, you could do the math. Injuries in people who stand all day are well documented in people who have to work factory work all the time, and nurses, and people who are unable to get off of their feet all day. So while it is a solution in that it brings about new loads and changes blood vessel geometry and uses more muscle to stabilize you, I'm much more of a fan of a dynamic workstation, which means you can change between sitting and standing. And when you are standing, that you're not really standing still, that you are, I'm like right now, I'm doing this show with you, and I've been standing the entire time, but I have not been still. I've been stretching my calves, and I've been stretching the tops of my feet and moving my toes. And so I stay moving, even though my face might not be leaving the computer screen, which seems to be, you know, why we have to be in front of our office so much of the time.
Yeah. You mentioned passive loads are matter too. I mean, explain how you sleep, because you don't have a pillow or really a conventional mattress.
No. You know, there's a big article circulating around about texting and how much time we spend with our head out in front of our body, looking down at, you know, your device or whatever it is, your smartphone. And then People go home, though, and get into their bed only to prop their head so that it is, in fact, jutting out in front of their body. The difference between standing and texting with your head forward and laying in your bed with forward is that gravity is working in a different direction. So it's not quite the same load, but we have been putting a pillow behind our head for so long that we've adapted to needing it. And most of us just issue our children a pillow at, you know, as soon as they start sleeping in their own bed, because we've always had one and they want one because they see us with one. And we start eking the spine into this forward headed position that then as adults, we spend our time and money searching for the exercises or the, you know, health services that alleviate the fact that our head is out in front of us, while at the same time practicing it. We've been forming ourselves in this way because of perceived comfort, because if you do something long enough, then you usually need to do it to continue to stay comfortable.
One of the things you say early on in the book is that you live a very particular kind of movement lifestyle. Mm. It's very important to you. You and your husband and your kids, you're all in for the most part,
yeah,
I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
But you don't want you say you don't want to freak people out about their health in the book. And I'm guessing you also don't necessarily want them to feel guilty about living up to some impossible standard. I mean, you want to highlight how important movement is, how crucial it is. But what are the suggestions, the kind of practical suggestions for people, as opposed to ditching their kitchen table tomorrow, which they may do eventually? Where do you think they should start?
The easiest place to start would be simply using your living room furniture less. So instead of, you don't have to get rid of your couch. You certainly don't need to be that extreme, but you don't have to sit in it all the time. You can sit on the floor in front of it. So you still have a normal house, you know, by all standards, but you can sit on a pillow, prop your hips up on a pillow and just sit on the floor. Ironically, assuming a position with your knees and your hips, usually some sort of stretch-like position that you usually go to exercise class to do, right? You usually go to exercise class to help have someone put you in a position to stretch your hips and your knees. Well, you can do that just by not sitting on your couch. That's one easy way. The second easy way is to transition out of over-supportive, over foot limiting footwear, foot motion limiting footwear. You know, anything that if you stepped on a piece of paper in a bare foot and you trace your foot with your weight on your foot and saw how the toes would spread, and then you take your shoe and you put your shoe on top of that footprint, so many times that shoe is smaller than your actual footprint. And so if you could just change one or two pairs of your shoes that you wear on a regular basis to a shoe that would allow more of your body to participate in the walking that you were already doing, no extra schedule or anything else, just putting on something different in the morning, that would be huge. So those are two easy ways.
You mentioned there are so many suggestions in the book. I really recommend people taking a look at this, changing the grade of your walk or your hike, learning to walk properly, learning to stand properly, all of those kinds of things. So when I go on a hike later this afternoon, should I be mixing it up, not going on the same one, for example? Yeah.
That's another easy way to just, if you already walk, but let's say you walk out your house, you make a left, you make a loop, and you come back in, just head to the right this time. Do the same loop, just do it in the other direction. If that's too much, do the same loop, but walk on the other side of the road where the lumps and bumps of the road might be a little bit unexpected. If you have the opportunity, walk on the grass that sits right next to the sidewalk, because the flat and level, so much of what we consume in our walking is flat and level. One of the most unnatural surfaces, the surface that would occur almost never in nature, is the walking surface, and therefore the geometry of the body that you would almost never get. So we've totally overdosed on vitamin flat and level. So if you feel, though, very limited, so many times there is a lumpy, bumpy path just next to the part of your sidewalk or the part of your groomed trail, you know, if you're out hiking, that you always take. Just move 6 inches over. We're such a creature of habit. You know, we sit in the same room. If you go to school or if you go to a conference, you always pick the same side. Just start being aware of how repetitious we position ourselves physically, and just start playing with that. So again, that's another really good example.
You know, it seems like, isn't the one constant in all of human and, well, all life in general, isn't it change and adaptation? Mm-hmm. So as humans, our reality is no longer hunter-gatherer societies, obviously. So can't our bodies, you know, adjust and better adapt to a modern reality, a more sedentary reality? I mean, do we always have to just recreate these, you know, paleo existences?
Well, adaptation is what we are after. So adaptation, it doesn't necessarily, you know, mean improvement. It just means, or it doesn't mean improvement in the grandest scheme of things. Yeah. It just allows you to deal with a particular environment. So yes, we want to stay adapted, or certainly adaptable to our modern environment. However, if I told you vitamin C was no longer available in this modern environment, you still couldn't function without it.
Yeah.
Because that timeline takes too long for how rapidly we are making these inputs, where you have to actually search to go find them. And, you know, we've come up with vitamin and mineral supplements, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's become more and more challenging to get these nutrients that we need. So we have to go out and supplement them. So in the same way, we are going to have to go out and supplement them. And I see that as something different than heralding the, you know, the primal or the ancestral way as being the best way, and we should return to it. That's why I choose really to think about it in terms of a nutrient. I think it makes it a lot easier to just understand that nutrients take, I don't know how long, but if it's a nutrient, it means that it's essential input, and that just because we no longer find ourselves close to plants that give us vitamin C, or they're no longer palatable to us, or we're not able to go grab them easily, doesn't mean that we don't need them any longer. And so that's really what I'm talking about, is that the reason I like the ancestral, like, picture your, you know, what it would be like for moving, is because we don't know anything about essential loads in the same way that we know information about essential nutrients. I believe it's going to take at least 60 to 100 years before we really get that. Oh, you need, you know, these types of cells need this and whatnot to keep them functioning well. So that until we have that data, I'm choosing to minimize the abnormal geometry in my life, which would be getting rid of my couch, just to hedge, you know, my bets a little bit.
Let me ask you this finally, because I love the last part of your book where you end with this metaphor between this process of transition when a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, how caterpillars, you say, basically dissolve themselves and then they grow all these new parts. But you say, we don't often realize that there's a human version of that transformation process. We only have about a minute left, but would you say something about that finally?
I think that if you understood just how malleable you are as a human constantly turning over yourself, that you would explore many more options to change your physical experience if it's not working for you. And that's what I would just like to reinforce, is you do have a very large ability to transform, and you will feel better.
Katie Bowman. She blogs and podcasts at katiesays.com. We'll put a link to that on our website. She joined us from her home in Washington. Katie Bowman, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.